Make the choice to begin anywhere in your life, and the journey has started.
We exist more than just to educate. We exist to also revitalize.
And along the way, you can inspire others and be inspired.
But now there's a new generation of scholars, and I am among them.
If you really want to know who you are and what you are capable of, Howard is the choice for you.
Take a moment. Listen to the stories by joining the president of Howard University, Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, and his guest on The Journey.
Public health emergency has been tragic for all of us. Howard University has been at the forefront of caring and advising communities in the District of Columbia. Today, we announced the new Howard University Community Health Initiative and how this will be impactful for those in underserved areas. Hello, my name is Dr. Wayne Frederick, and my guest today on the journey is Dr. Reed Tuckson. He is currently the chair of the Health Sciences Committee of the Board of Trustees here at Howard University. Dr. Tuckson, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So you are from Washington, D.C. originally. Tell me what it was like when you grew up in Washington, D.C. What part of the city did you grow up in?
I grew up in far northeast in a complex called Mayfair Mansions, which during those days, this city was so highly segregated that there were black folks lived in very isolated parts of the city. And Mayfair Mansions was a wonderful place to grow up because we were all together. There was no distinction between class, professionalism, how much money you made. We were all together as one village. And I was cared for and cared about by a large number of extended family members who made sure that every time I even thought of doing something wrong, I was going to get my hand back.
With respect to Washington, D.C. at that time, what was the school system like, and what in your early days in school, especially given what your parents did, really influenced you in terms of your own career path?
I was very, very, very lucky. My mother was and is a nurse. And so I grew up around her because she was so inspirational to me because she was a visiting nurse. My mother every day put on a uniform, grabbed a black bag, and went into the poorest parts of D.C. to take care of those who were most in need. My father was a professor at the Howard University in the College of Dentistry. And so for my early schooling and my early role models, they were very much around the people devoting their lives to service, to the health of others. And it was very much around the idea of academic excellence as portrayed by the physicians and dentists and other health professionals at Howard University. I was a very, very lucky child to be exposed to these influences at an early age.
And as you attended undergrad here at Howard, at that period of time, there was a lot going on in Washington, D.C., and I would say in the political landscape in America. What about that time you remember the most in terms of how it probably shaped you in your young adulthood?
I was very clearly shaped by my exposure to the political leaders of the time and to be around people like Stokely Carmichael, and Dr. Ewart Brown and others of that ilk who were very, very progressive in their politics. I certainly was a part of that.
And then you went across town for medical school, probably a very significant contrast. What was that experience like in contrast to your experience in undergrad?
It was an incredibly difficult experience to walk across town to a really segregated Georgetown. It was still almost segregated at that time. And there were five African Americans in a class of 205. And so it was a real wake-up call that gave me the sense of the difference between being at Howard in the loving family and over there, where our very first lecturer in orthopedics was a physician who showed a picture of a black man being lynched to illustrate a point about neck strain. So I knew I was in a different environment than at Howard at that moment.
Certainly understand that. You would go on to train at UPenn in a primary care specialty, which we know right now is so much needed. And especially in the middle of this pandemic, we're recognizing just how much more we even need that. What types of principles were embedded in you during that training experience that prepared you for your current roles that would follow?
University of Pennsylvania was an excellent experience for me because it taught me the fundamentals of looking at the patient holistically, looking at how all of the elements that affect and shape the experience with disease and the prevention of disease, how do all of them come together? The other thing that was particularly useful for me was not only an attentiveness to quality of care, but the cost effectiveness of care, being thoughtful about not wasting healthcare resources and not causing patients to have to spend more money than they should have to get the quality of care that they deserve.
Right. Now, over the course of the 80s, especially when we look at the HIV epidemic, you played a significant role in the city's healthcare system. Why don't you describe the roles that you held in the public healthcare system in D.C. at that time and what you saw then that, again, you think can be translated to the current crisis that we're living?
It was my privilege to serve this city at the height of the AIDS epidemic, when it was really getting off the ground and moving with incredible ferocity and intensity. The thing that I learned more than anything else is the role and the importance of community engagement. We have so many wonderful community-based advocates and leaders in this city. They have a voice. They are the ones that other people in the community listen to. So what I learned through the HIV fight and what I'm doing now to be supportive in this fight is to bring those advocates together, listen to what they have to say, talk about what the messages are that we're giving to the community. Let them reframe those messages in their own way. And remember this, our communities, no matter how challenged, should be viewed in the context of their wholeness, not their deficits. We are not people with problems. We may have problems, but we're not problem people. We have resources and assets, and we need to tap into that. And so I'm very encouraged, Dr. Frederick, that what we are seeing now with this COVID fight, through something that we've organized called the Black Coalition Against COVID, we're putting those principles that we learned in HIV to play in this one. And we have so many now people from all across our community, whether they're the faith leaders, labor leaders, religious leaders, whether they're the youth, musicians, go-go artists, all of these constituencies are coming forward now to be a part of the fight against this disease and representing through their own integrity, their own lived experience, through the truthfulness of their own voices. They are the ones that will be transmitting the message forward. That's the only way we're going to succeed.
So let's talk a little bit about why this is even necessary. Here at Howard University Hospital, about 43 to 50% of our patients are from Ward 7 and 8. And unfortunately, in the district, when you look at African Americans, 46% of the population, 47% of all of the cases, but unfortunately, almost 80% of the deaths. So clearly, there's an issue. But why use community influencers to get those messages? What gap are they filling that you think has been missing when you look at those statistics?
The gap that has to be filled, first of all, is the trustworthiness of the message and the content of the message put in terms that regular people can understand and will have a predisposition to doing. Many people in our community, for very legitimate historical reasons, have a great distrust of governments, have a great distrust of the healthcare system. Secondly, too often when we think about the pre-existing problems that we as African Americans have that make us predisposed to this illness, we can be stigmatized as if somehow blaming the victim becomes appropriate, that we should be blamed for our own challenges and issues. We need the community to be able to stand up to everyone and say, regardless of all of those kinds of stigmatizations and concerns about being misused, we're in for a fight for our lives. So I think the role of community leaders are really now to close the gap between the message and the messenger, to close the gap between what is being said and whether or not what is being requested can actually be done. There are many rate-limiting steps, as you well know, Dr. Frederick, for people living in our communities to follow the guidance that have been given for COVID-19. So we have to address the social environment and those barriers and hurdles. The community itself is very helpful in getting rid of some of those barriers. So for all of those reasons, I would say that you cannot win this fight in our community without an active, engaged, empowered, and motivated community leadership.
So health communications is clearly one of the issues, and obviously with the coalition, it sounds like you're going to fill a much-needed gap. Another issue is really testing, the practicality of testing and then subsequently doing contact tracing. Let's talk about testing first. What do you see as the need for testing in those communities? How is that going to help bring about better health for the communities in Ward 7 and 8 as an example, and throughout the nation where you have underrepresented minorities in the majority in particular neighborhoods?
We have benefited from the worldwide experience of other countries as they have expanded their testing and made it so eminently available to their citizenry, which allows them to be able to not only find people early and intervene, but also to be able to identify hotspots and be able then to isolate those hotspots and be able to deal with them effectively. It is a tragedy that we do not have the opportunity for those who are in need to, for us to be able to give them tests and have rapid response of the answers back. This is a fundamental failure of the United States government, and one that I'm glad to see Howard University starting to fill with its testing program east of the river. So that is a critical issue. We've got to be able to address fixing this problem.
And then once those tests come back, the issue of contact tracing. Does contact tracing look the same in Southeast DC as it may look in other parts of the city in Northwest DC?
Well, here's the hard part, and I think the thesis of your question is this. We already know that in the African-American community, there is such a distrust over government interference in our lives. But let me emphasize as strongly as I can, Dr. Frederick, if we are unable to implement effectively the triad of testing, identification of the intimate contacts of a person who is testing positive for this disease, and then have those intimate contacts isolate for 14 days. If we do not have those three things in place, I can guarantee you that when we go back out into the streets, when the city begins to open up again, this virus will rebound through our community like a ping pong ball. And all the disparities that we are seeing today will be worsened. So I am pleading with every citizen in the District of Columbia, if you become positive and health professionals reach out to you and say, I need to know who your intimate contacts have been, who are the people you've been around, who have you exposed yourself to, then we're going to need for those individuals anonymously, those individuals will then need to be honest about their exposure. And if they are determined that they need to isolate for 14 days, they need to do that. If we don't, this virus spreads like wildfire through our community again. And I really would hate to see that happen.
It looks like well beyond the COVID-19 pandemic, an institution like this Black Coalition could really take root in helping close the disparities in the city. What do you see down the line once we get past this pandemic for the role that the Black Coalition Against COVID could play?
The infrastructure that is set up now is an infrastructure that I think will be able to survive the COVID vaccine, the COVID virus episode, and will be there for the future. For example, one of the things that I am so pleased that you have lent your support for is Howard University supporting four of our churches east of the river to create what we call health ministries. And so what we're now finding is that the church itself is using its own members to become health deputies for the rest of the congregation, and then connecting in with social workers, and in this case, social workers from Howard University's faculty and students, to be able to navigate problems that are identified through this process of engagement. I think these health ministries and this model is a model that will survive well beyond the COVID epidemic and become an infrastructure issue that will serve us well as we continue the fight for life and the fight for health in our community.
Well, I'm certainly grateful to you and your wife for your generous seven-figure gift to Howard University that made that possible, and your continued support, not just with your volunteerism on the board, but certainly with your treasure. And so as we wrap, every alumnus who comes on this show, I have one closing question, and that is, why Howard University?
Why Howard University? Because a commitment to academic excellence and a mission of translating academic excellence into service to the world and service to our people.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tuckson. It's great to have you.
Thank you, my brother.
Thanks for being here today. My guest today has been Dr. Reed Tuckson. He's the chair of the Health Sciences Committee of the Board of Trustees here at Howard University. and he's also the convener of the Howard University Community Health Initiative. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.